Turn to Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4. This will be the second half of two sermons on the subject of education, particularly verse 4, children, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. We spent 2 weeks on discipline, and we want now to spend 2 weeks on instruction. This is the second week, and I want to talk about the different schooling options that we face. Now, I first spoke on this subject back in April of 2001, and at that time, we had our children in a conventional Christian school, had them in Veritas with its compressed day, and we had homeschooled. We had been personally involved in those three options. Then later we put them into a private secular school, and I look back over my notes and I don't find that I have anything really that I want to change about what was said 8 years ago based on the experience that we have had so far. I find that I'm pretty much in the same place that I was and have the same convictions. I think the same wisdom issues are involved. I think that all of the choices involve compromises of one sort or another. Some involve more compromise than others. There are a number of variables involved in the choices. I can't even list them all because they are so numerous. And because they are so numerous, such as the location of the school, the cost of the school, the breadth of education provided by the school, the facilities, the enrichment potential, the extracurricular program. And we could go on and talk about the various dimensions of education. And then you have the human variables, which are, they're not infinitely complex because we're finite beings, but they're very complex. There's the individual child and what is suitable to that child. There's the social dynamic of the institution that's in question and whether or not that fits well or has over the previous period of time fit well for that child. These are all variables. And what that means, I think, for us is that this is a judgment that we can't make for each other. A previous generation didn't give a thought to any of these things. My parents, I don't think that they even once thought about where I would go to school. It wasn't an issue. It wasn't a discussion. It wasn't a debate. They didn't wrestle over the question. They sent me down the street, about a half a mile's walk to the elementary school. I jumped on a bus to the junior high school then and jumped on the bus for the high school. That was it. I was in that public school district. That's where I went. And I don't think they ever thought about it. There was no hand wringing in our house about where the Johnson children were going to go to school. We just went where we were told to go, and that was it. And I think that's the way it was for most of my generation. There weren't any other options. Or if they were, they weren't even considered. My generation has wrestled mightily with these questions. And generations on down now, the parents of young children, they're all wrestling with it. They have options. They need to have options. Often some of the options are utterly intolerable. They are beyond consideration. The things that parents were doing a couple of generations ago in the public system or in a private school, the present generation wouldn't even consider it because of deterioration in one aspect or another of education. So it's a new world. It's a new game, as it were, for parents. And it's a very serious one. And it's extraordinary the lengths to which parents will go to ensure that their children get the right education. I think that homeschooling, for example, is a testimony all by itself to the extraordinary limits that parents will go in order to see to it that their children get the education that they want. I was part of, I think I've mentioned this before, but I was part of the Christian Education and Publications Committee of the denomination, permanent committee. And they were having trouble raising funds. And so I in a very, very inconsiderate way, I'm sure, said, this is not a committee that ought to have trouble raising money. In my experience, parents today are making extraordinary sacrifices, financial and otherwise, in order to educate their children. People are very interested in Christian education. We have scores of people in the PCA who are either homeschooling their children, who are spending themselves into oblivion trying to provide a Christian education for their children. So that there aren't funds that are available just is extraordinary to me, because there are funds available and people are spending them like drunken sailors in order to see to the education of their children. Tremendous interest, tremendous burden is being carried by parents today, largely because of the collapse of the public school system, or the perception of a collapse. And this varies from region to region. It's not true in every part of the country. But with the secularization of the schools, and then with the increasingly aggressive socialization agenda that we find in the schools, socialization that is in diversity, and diversity meaning the acceptance of all forms of sexual behavior as legitimate and normal, if not desirable, that has caused a crisis of confidence in the public school system, a flight of parents out of that system, and a willingness to make tremendous sacrifices to see that they are educated in a way that isn't so directly hostile to the nurturing interests of the parents. So as we talk about these options, I know I'm in a minefield. I know that this is a dangerous subject to bring up. I know that I am likely to offend people. I also know that while we will speak of there being compromises on no matter what option we exercise, and that there's a sense in which no one can decide for anyone else, I also know that parents make decisions for bad reasons. So because there are diversities of decisions doesn't mean that every option is equally viable or desirable, or that, in fact, sometimes parents don't make decisions based on carnal interests. Their own comfort might be one, or reputation might be one, convenience, an inordinate interest in parental convenience as opposed to the welfare of the children might be another. We have to recognize that there are a variety of motives, a variety of options, and yet not all motives, and nor are all options equally legitimate. And sometimes we make mistakes and misjudge the motives that we have for educating our children in the way that we have. And sometimes for some of us, there's going to be considerable lament later when we look back and say, if only I had, I wish that I had made this other decision. So here are the options as I see them. One would be to homeschool. I think that this is the most difficult to do well, but done well, I think it is the best option. I don't think you can improve upon a one-on-one tutorial. I mean, that's the way kings are educated, right? A one-on-one tutorial. You get an outstanding tutor, and you give that student one-on-one oversight, direction, encouragement, and help. I don't see how that can be improved upon. So I think it's a legitimate option for Christian families. If it is done well, it seems to me that this is the best method. I think that way the student gets the most attention. I think that way the student is getting the most help that he needs or she needs. It's individualized help. It's not a teacher addressing a classroom full of people. So done well, the one-on-one tutorial, it provides opportunity to explore areas of interest without having to conform to a schedule, a calendar that says you must cover this material in this amount of time. There's flexibility. There's efficiency. Again, because of the one-on-one ratio. Negatively, I think it is the most difficult to do for one person to teach multiple subjects. And then when there are multiple children involved, it just seems to me that it's the most difficult thing to do. I think there are some people who do a very, very outstanding job of it. They are gifted and they're able to teach. They have the gifts of teaching and they do very, very well at it. And there are some star students to the astonishment of our leading universities that are homeschooled and end up at Harvard. I mean, it's happening all the time now. We're winning the spelling bees and these sorts of competitions. There are parents who are doing an outstanding job. On the other hand, there are a number of parents who are doing a miserable job. And they're cutting corners, and their children are losing out because of it. There's also the social aspect of learning, which is legitimate. It's a concern. I think it's a legitimate concern. Students will tend to study better in a social context. They're also distracted in a social context. That would be the negative. But I can remember with homeschooling, I can remember wrestling with the children to get them to do work. And then you put them in a classroom, and the teacher says, pull out your books, and they pull out their books. And you say, write in your journal, and they don't go, and they don't whine and complain and fuss about having to write in their journal. They write in their journal. Why? Because everyone else is, and because that's what's being done, and that's what the teacher said to do. So there are certain social aspects of learning that are an advantage, that are a benefit to children. And the one-on-one can be very difficult without that social aspect. They also, homeschooling, lose some of the peer education, by which I mean the peers of children tend to be pretty rough on each other. Brutal is the word I would use for middle school. Middle school is brutal. That can be bad. There are the spirit of particularly tender-hearted, fragile children can be crushed by that environment. On the other hand, what peers tend to do is knock off the rough edges. Nobody tells it to you like your peers. It's one of the reasons why I like having an age-based Sunday school, and why I'm a little bit fearful when I find people hiding out in other age groups in the Sunday school system. It's among your peers that you get the straight talk. It's your peers that knock off the rough edges. It's your peers that are willing to confront you. It's your peers that are willing to tell it like it is. And we all need that to a certain degree. And you'll find with homeschooling, there's some kids who just have rough edges. They don't know how to behave amongst their peers. They've indulged certain sinful tendencies that would have gotten knocked off. Now, our counter-argument would be they probably would have picked up a lot more damaging ones in a social setting. That may be the case. So we're talking about positive and negatives, and there's some of both. The argument against the peers is that they are virtually independent of their peers and the opinions of the peers as homeschooled children. That's a good thing, to a certain extent. They're not peer-dependent in the same way that children are who are warehoused all day long from the time they're 5 years old until they're 18 years old. Of course they're peer-dependent. Of course they look to their peers to inform them as to what opinions they ought to have about fashion and about culture and about music and about everything else that they slavishly follow their peers with respect to and no longer consider the opinions of their parents. Of course there's peer dependence. You're spared that to a significant degree when you homeschool. On the other hand, there's a lot of rough edges that don't get knocked off because your peers will slap you around a little bit, and that's probably a good thing. For most of us, this is the reason why the difficulty of homeschooling is one of the reasons why hybrids are flourishing. There are probably very few, I don't have the numbers, very few people who strictly homeschool. What most are doing is who are homeschooling now are predominantly homeschooling, but they are checking into co-ops and other educational alternatives as time passes, because it's just overwhelming, especially at the upper ages, to do all of those and do it well. I mean, I teach one subject, history. I was teaching it to homeschoolers at one time, and I have a history major, and I was putting all sorts of energy into it, and it made me reflect on the experience of a typical sixth grade teacher who is teaching that, and that's just one of six subjects every day that he or she has to prepare for. There's no way that they could go into it at the depth at which I could do by myself. So it made sense for other homeschoolers to send their children to me. Thus, Veritas was born, or began to grow, as homeschoolers began to cooperate. And still today, at Veritas, there are homeschool children who plug in. Why? Because it's difficult to do it all by yourself. But it is certainly a legitimate option and a good option for those who are able to do it well, And then as it gets even more difficult for the parents to handle, when they're able to take advantage of other educational institutions that offer classes to their children or could help with higher mathematics or the sciences. Okay, so homeschool, legitimate option for Christian families. Secondly, Christian school. It would seem to me this is the second best option, again, looking at these theoretically, if it is a truly Christian school. The positives would be, I think, that you have home, church, and school all in harmony with each other. You're not learning something different in each environment. What the home is saying, the church is saying, and the school is saying. I think that's a good thing, especially at the younger ages. You don't want confusion. You don't want them being learning one thing at home, going off to church, and then they're learning something else at church, and then going off to school, and they're learning something else altogether. I can remember, for me, there was this tremendous gap growing up between my friends at Sunday school and my friends at church. I mean, my friends at church and my friends at school. I can remember being on the playground thinking about that, that I had my church friends, and they were Christians, and we talked about the Bible. And we talked about God, and we talked about Jesus, and we talked about salvation. And that was on Sunday. And then I went to school all week, and none of that ever came up. Do you recall thinking about that? I thought about that as a little kid, as a young child. That disturbed me. That bothered me. They seemed to be two different worlds, and there was no intersection between those two worlds. They were utterly divorced from each other. I couldn't make sense of that. I didn't know how to handle that. It almost raised the question of the reality. Which world was the real world and the truer world between the two? So I think ideally our young people are not facing that kind of dichotomy or separation, that there's integration between what's happening at home, what's happening in church, and what's happening at the school. Those should be in agreement. This is why over the centuries, Christians have started schools. This is why Presbyterians in this country started churches and schools simultaneously, side by side, right up until the middle of the 19th century. That was what was common. That was what was typical. Ministers taught in schools. They preached on Sundays and they taught in schools Monday through Friday. The schools started by churches or groups of Christians. Why? Because Christian parents want their children educated according to the convictions that they have in church on Sunday. Because church doesn't end on Sunday. Church is all about life, right? It's about the way that we view God and humanity and the world and all of the big issues. So there's a natural desire from parents to want their children to be educated according to the convictions that they have on Sunday. And not be educated according to convictions that are contrary to those or that undermine those or weaken those. Or conflict with those. Why set up that kind of a hostile environment for your child? So that's the very natural desire of parents. That very natural desire has been acted upon from the very beginning, going back to the early church educational institutions were established for the education of young people. So that they would learn the truth about God and about the world that God has made and the people that God has put in that world. It wasn't enough to be educated by pagans. It wasn't enough to just send them off to some Roman or Greek scholar who had no concept of reality as understood by the church and by Christian people. So you've got home, school, church in harmony with each other. I say if it's the second best option, if it is truly a Christian, by which I mean the teachers are Christian, the curriculum is Christian, and the families that make up the school are Christians, so that we're all operating off of the same page. We all have the same convictions. We all have the same priorities. We have the same desires. I'm not going to go to a school board meeting and be wrestling with the other parents over moral and religious issues. They won't be arguing with me whether or not there's too much Bible or too much religion in the Christian school. Because it's got a Christian name but doesn't have the Christian reality. So a Christian school, it seems to me, is The second best option, or if you think of homeschooling and Christian schooling as the same thing in different forms, a Christian education is what we want to provide for our children. And that's where we left off last week, is that we are required to provide our children with a Christian education. Two viable options are to homeschool and to place them in a Christian school. I don't think it's a panacea. I don't think that the school as an institution can replace parents and their oversight, their awareness, their superintending or supervising of the education that the Christian school is providing. I think that parental involvement is mandatory even when they are enrolled in the Christian school. But at least if it's a Christian school that's truly Christian, that single voice has the opportunity of being attained. That my convictions on Sunday will be reflected Monday through Friday by the teachers that are teaching my children, and the classmates that my child encounters will be from families who hold the same convictions as do we. The negative on the Christian school would be the problem that is admittedly to a significant degree anecdotal, but that problem is the problem of inoculation. And the degree to which the school fails to be a truly Christian school, the problem, again, this is anecdotal, increases. By which I mean, if you are exposed to the gospel every single day and it's not being presented well, or there's an internal inconsistency or hypocrisy about the way the school is presenting that gospel, then what you will tend to do is inoculate them with a weakened version of the real thing. That's the way inoculations work, right? You take damaged cells of the disease and you inject it into the body, and then you're able to withstand the real thing. Well, this is what happens with a Christian school that's only Christian in name or has a compromised or a corrupted version of the real thing. It ends up inoculating the children. What they end up doing is they reject the weakened version. They reject the false version of it. They think they know what Christianity is all about. And all that they do really know is they know what they experienced in the Christian school, which was flawed, perhaps deeply flawed, perhaps profoundly hypocritical. And so that's the image that the students at the Christian school take away from them. This is what Christianity is. It is this corrupt thing. It is this hypocritical thing. I went to a Christian school, but all my classmates were virtually indistinguishable from those who were in the pagan school. And my teachers were as bad as the students. And we had chapel once a week, but that was it. Otherwise, we were drinking Freud and Darwin to the same degree, drinking them down just like they were in the public schools that are pagan and secular. And so you end up with children, and like I say, this is to a significant degree anecdotal, who are inoculated and who have very little passion for Christ, very little zeal for Christ. You have the bitter, bitter irony of children who have gone off to a public school and have had to encounter opposition and hostility every single day. And as a result, they come out strong. They come out zealous for Christ and his kingdom because they've had to fight for their faith every day. And then there's the children in the Christian school who just they've been force-fed for their academic careers, and they take it all for granted. No passion, no zeal, no desire to serve. So I'm brushing in broad strokes here, but I think that you know some of the dangers and some of the fears, and you've seen some of the reality in the Christian schools that you've been associated with. So while the ideal is wonderful, sometimes the reality has been less desirable and disappointing and disheartening to see how that many of the children who were given all the advantages and the parents sacrificing enormously to provide the expensive Christian education for their children, and the result being very, very lukewarm children. lukewarm children who seem not to have a Christian worldview. For all that, a Christian world and life view not even being taught, not even understanding Christian ethics, not understanding a Christian view of humanity and the world and God and so forth. Very, very disheartening. So the ideal is wonderful. What are the options for Christian parents? You can homeschool. You can send them to a Christian school. I would just warn you, be sure it's a Christian school and not a counterfeit. And again, that's where parental responsibility comes in. Maybe that's the only option you have, as opposed to an extremely hostile, decadent, amoral, state-run school. Maybe there's a Christian school that's your only option, and it's a very flawed option. Well, then you have to be involved in it. You've got to be right in the middle of things, saying to your children, look, this has got a Christian name on it, and there's some things about it that are better than the state-run option, but you need to know that this is not what we consider to be Christian in the true sense of the word. Here's the weaknesses. Here's the flaws. Be aware of that. Don't misunderstand your experience. Don't misunderstand where you are in the environment in which you're being educated. So the Christian school is in its ideal, is highly desirable one for parents, because it is our passion, it is our dream, our hope that our children will be educated in school, hour by hour, day by day, in a fashion that is consistent with our own religious convictions that are the basis upon which we chose the church home that we have. So that church, family, school are all speaking with one voice. Then I want to say, and I would enhance that a little bit. I would say that we want a broadly Christian education. I think I went into this in some detail last time, that the curriculum should engage all the academic disciplines. I think that there are many advantages for our children to instruct them in Latin and the classical languages, to have a history-based curriculum, to emphasize lots of reading because we are a people of the book and so forth and so on. We can refine the model to make it the best Christian education that we are able to. Then finally, the secular school. I think that this is the least attractive option, whether it's public or private. I also think it's the most dangerous option. I'm not an absolutist on this, though. I think that you can hire an unbeliever to teach your child math. If you were a homeschooling parent, you could bring an unbeliever in and teach your child to play the piano. You can do that. That's a legitimate thing to do. You take some skill, some knowledge that somebody has that's not a Christian, and you could supervise their educating of your child in that area, that specific area that you have in mind, finding some help. I think that if you just broaden that principle, you can hire a given school to provide your children with an education. But you're going to have to be keenly aware and involved of what's going on. Day by day, conversations about what's going on in the classroom. Maybe in your conviction, that's the best option for a number of reasons. Maybe that's where they'll get the best education. Maybe that's where they'll be able to continue their musical education. Maybe that's where they'll be able to continue to study Latin. Maybe where the best reading program or study program or great books program is to be found. Or some other thing that you have in mind as being important for the education of your children. I think you can exercise that option, but you still must provide your children with a Christian education. How do you do that? By being aware of what's going on in the classroom and rebutting it daily, so that they're learning the facts, but the philosophies being rebutted. Is that a difficult thing to do? Yes, very difficult thing to do. Very difficult to stay on top of it. Very difficult to be aware exactly of what's going on in the classroom. I think the positives might be such things as maybe this is where the academic program is the best. Or maybe this is, in the case of a public school, maybe this is where the cost is affordable. Maybe you have the kind of child that needs an adversarial environment in order to thrive as a Christian. There just are people like that. I want to say I grew most as a Christian. Granted, it was a college age where you're a little bit older and more able to stand up to it. I grew the most when I was an undergraduate at USC. Fighting every day, literally, I mean, getting in the classroom, putting on my boxing gloves and going at it with my professors, particularly my junior and senior years. So I don't think that we can be absolutist about this. I think that there are reasons why one may consider the best option to be a secular option, be it private or public. It is certainly the most dangerous and the least desirable option, all things considered. The problem is, all things are not always equal. They're not equal. They're very, very unequal. There are different children. There are different schools. There are different classes within schools. There are location issues and cost issues. The variables are many. There isn't anyone that can make this call for any one family. We can't decide this for each other, I don't think, because there are too many variables in our humanity and in our circumstances. I think that if you're going to put them in a secular school, you should only do it if you're ready to debrief your child on virtually a daily basis, and thereby turn this perhaps hostile, certainly secular education into a Christian education through the means of what I would consider to be daily tutorials. So to make these decisions, what we need is honesty and wisdom. If we're going to homeschool, are we going to do it well? If we're going to put them into a Christian school, are we going to follow up and deprogram? If they're going to put them into a secular, are we going to have daily tutorials where we are reviewing and rebutting what's taking place in the classroom? Now, I'm already over time, but I want to throw out a number of questions for you raised by the curriculum. So you just got to sit and put up with it. I want to know of the curriculum in the school. I want to know how they answer the questions raised by the curriculum. Who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? As you study literature, science, and the social science, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, or mostly good or mostly bad? For example, the Puritans. What does your school have to say about the Puritans? Are they mostly the good guys or are they mostly bad guys? In the curriculum of the school to which you send your children, are Puritans narrow, negative, joyless, repressed, legalists? Or are they gracious, world-affirming, joyful, hardworking, and admirable? What is taught about the Pilgrim's Fathers, about John Winthrop, Oliver Cromwell, John Bunyan, the writer of Pilgrim's Progress, John Milton, the writer of Paradise Lost, Jonathan Edwards? Is all they know that he wrote is that he preached sinners in the hands of an angry God? Do they not know that he is also probably the greatest philosophical mind that America ever produced? How about behind them? What's said about Calvin and Luther and Knox? Good guys or bad guys? How about the Middle Ages? The Middle Ages mostly good or mostly bad? The Middle Ages, are they a dark age where classical culture was suppressed by the church, which ushered in an era of superstition and ignorance? Or were the Middle Ages an era in which classical culture was saved and preserved by the church from the barbarians of Europe, who in turn were converted to Christianity, whose barbarism was likewise transformed into chivalry? What do they have to say about Augustine, about the monks, and about the Crusades? Are those things, can those things be understood? Is there a positive aspect? Or are the Crusaders nothing but bad guys and the monks deluded and bizarre people who lived in isolation from reality? How about the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason? Was that a good or a bad development? And to what extent was it good and to what extent was it bad? Are they going to say that there is an absolute discontinuity between the Enlightenment and the Reformation, so that reason rescues science from religion? Is that what we are to understand the Reformation to be, or rather the Enlightenment to be? Or are we to understand that there's continuity between the Enlightenment and the Reformation in its positives, and that in fact the Enlightenment led to a reign of terror insofar as it was cut loose from biblical religion? It led to a reign of terror. And Napoleon because of its very defiance of Christian revelation. What does your curriculum have to say about Descartes and Locke and Voltaire and Rousseau, the American Revolution and the French Revolution? How about the Industrial Revolution and the Scientific Revolution? Copernicus, Galileo, Newton. Are these people who represent the first leading edge of those who are finally freed from the shackles of the church and therefore make great discoveries? Or again, is there continuity arising out of a Christian worldview? Is there a recognition that without Christianity, there would have been no scientific revolution? And that's the testimony of atheistic scientists themselves. The Industrial Revolution, is it a movement that has resulted in the destruction of the environment, the oppression of workers, unjust and intolerable societies, rescued by Marxist revolution? Or is the Industrial Revolution largely positive, bringing prosperity and material well-being, ending famine and material deprivation, and bringing material well-being and providing a material foundation for health care and the extension of longevity of life? Is the Industrial Revolution mainly to be known by robber barons who are finally slain by Marx? Or is the Industrial Revolution largely a positive benefit for the human world, for the humankind? Then the modern world. How are we to understand and interpret Darwin, Marx, Freud, and what they have to say about human origins and about the human consciousness and the goal of human society? What are we to make of our modern world of tolerance and pluralism and acceptance? What does the curriculum say about our understanding of biology and psychology and sociology and history and political science and literature? Is your school afraid of these subjects, or is it willing to engage them and debate the ideas that have arisen from these movements, engage them and interpret them in light of Christian truth? Well, it's obvious probably what I want my schools to be saying about each of these things. I just bring them up so that parents would be aware of the options and not be indifferent to the perspective that is given on these movements and these issues. To tune in and know what's going on in your school and be ready to correct and rebut wherever that is necessary. We want excellence in our education. Where can we provide excellence? We want comprehensiveness in our education as well. We want them to be educated comprehensively as well as outstandingly. So that, on this note we end, we will be able to transmit to our children the faith that we hold in such a way that it will endure in the hostile environment that our world has become. As we pray together. Our Father in heaven, we pray that you would give us the wisdom that we need to make these decisions, that we would make right decisions, that we would base the decisions upon principle and wisdom and our perception of that which is best for the family and for the children and for all who are involved. We confess that we lack that wisdom, that these decisions are difficult for us. Our ideals are outstanding. The reality, O Lord, so often falls short. So guide us to the great end that you might be a God to us and to our children after us. In Jesus' name, amen.